by appearing in the New York Times. Horvitz once said, "I wish I could play like Art Tatum." And people were set back. Why would the greatest living pianist, perhaps the greatest living pianist at the time, say that? "I wish I could play like Art Tatum." And I couldn't understand that statement for about 2 or 3 weeks. And then it finally dawned on me, and I think I'm quite right, that he could not improvise classical music. He had, with all of that technique, there was one thing that he could not do that Tatum would do all the time. Okay, here we go with Tatum now.
There really is an internet problem, I guess, huh?
Yeah, we have a bit of a problem, so still working on it.
Weird.
Okay, well, then I can keep going, I guess?
Yeah.
Yes, please.
Okay, well, I'm so sorry that this is happening, because I want you to hear this kind of thing. Thinking of patterns, when we think of those patterns that came out of the Chopin etudes, both hands in separate pieces, doing the same kind of thing, confronting the same issue, dealt with, and in Chopin's involvement visually, if you will, with patterns, to write these patterns into existence and create a kind of super exercise that defies reality, like, my God, after learning all of these notes, all of a sudden the music is great and it becomes immortal. We hear these pieces 200 years after they were written. These recordings were made in a little, you know, just for listening right now. Here we go. Okay, now, in listening to that, did you notice that Tatum went into double time and played the piece twice as fast? And to listen to the stride left hand, remember that he created a portable orchestra, as it were, a miniature orchestra, a rhythm. He had a rhythm section in the left hand going at a terrific pump. You know, oompa, oompa, oompa is the stride piano involvement, and that's what we heard almost all the way through. Now, one of the realities in the next piece, which is called The Shout, this is one of the few original compositions that Tatum, we can't say wrote because he couldn't say, but he conceived of it, and he called it The Shout. Listen carefully to the patterns, especially in the right hand, as to how brilliant they are and how analogous they are to the ways that Chopin wrote music 200 years ago. Here is something called The Shout with Art Tatum.
Art Tatum at the piano. He plays an original composition, full of color, and 88 times 88 notes. The Shout. ¶¶
Notice the clarity? Again, see, the question, and you may not agree philosophically, but I have to think about the question, is this man, or was this man, the equal of any piano player that we've ever heard? It has nothing to do with the difference between Chopin and pop music. It has to do with the vehicle. Now, we're going to hear another tune, and listen to the stride piano. Listen to the left-hand technique this guy had, plus that power that comes out of the right hand. This piece is called Back in Town. That's
I thought
right.
You said you knew
Thank
it
you.
All, not to ask him anything.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm yeah. just a producer.
Lulu's Back in Town. You're just a, yeah,
Fine.
You're just a player here.
Okay.
Diabolism? How about a man possessed? Doesn't it sound as if this is a creature from another lagoon somewhere? I mean, how can all that be done? And again, did you notice any slippage on any note? How can this be done? How are we hearing what we are hearing? Now, the last aspect of what I'm doing today, all on Gershwin. Now, let's talk for a moment about Gershwin. 100 years ago, his friend Oscar Levant, one of the great humorists and a very close friend of Gershwin, who was in his 20s then, Gershwin asked, who had just become famous because of, Rhapsody in Blue, and of course, Swanee. And he asked Oscar, do you think they will be hearing my music 100 years from now? And of course, Levant had a humor, and without looking at him, he said, yeah, if you're still around. But the reality is that 100 years later, which is a year ago this August, last year, we heard the answer to the question, why is it that Tony Bennett, at age 93, a year ago, and Diana Krall decided to sing together Nothing But Gershwin? And that's the last, perhaps the last thing that Tony Bennett will ever do on video. Nothing But Gershwin. So Gershwin is here to stay. And again, such as what I'm doing between classical and jazz, consider now one of the other programs I did was a parallel impact upon the societies thereafter of Gershwin from Brooklyn and Mozart from Austria. We did this about a year or so ago. So you see, I am democratized. I am not a snob about music at all. I want you to hear just the basic denominator that comes out of this language we call music. Now, you're going to hear a rare recording, 1931, George Gershwin himself playing one of his great tunes, I Got Rhythm. Listen to him play. He was a muscular pianist, and I mean, he was a heck of a pianist, but he was not a great pianist because he didn't have a repertoire. He was interested in jazz primarily and fusion, which is, you know, is yet to come out of what he's been doing. Now, the reason I'm having you do hear this is that this is the first piece you've heard of Tatum today by a composer very well known in the pop field, and it's Tatum doing Gershwin, doing I Got Rhythm. That is after you hear Gershwin playing. Now, the reason I'm doing Gershwin playing first and Tatum second is, it's like in Mozart, one of the great things about a Mozart or a Beethoven is, what do you do with the material that comes out of the spirit? How do you work the music out? How do you write a 40-minute symphony based upon tunes that are maybe a minute long? The working of the rhythm and the music that come out of it. So what I'm saying is that Gershwin plays I Got Rhythm straight, wonderful arrangement that he does, and in the same key, Tatum, 20 years later, does his version of I Got Rhythm, and listen to what he extracts from the same chords that Gershwin plays. Here we go. We're going to hear them both.
Well, we have to wait a second, don't we?
No, it's part of the...
Oh, all right. I knew that. Okay.
It was part of the same clip. So, anyways.
So what do we do now?
I don't know. We could go out for coffee. No, here we go.
Tatum, man with the piano.
Here we are.
Okay.
Gershwin, man who wrote many a great song. Man meets song, I got rhythm.
know, you've heard all the music. Now, the question that I asked to begin the program, here's another question that's parallel. Why is it that Horowitz, who spoke very little of the contemporaries around him, the great pianists he knew and listened to along, I mean, they were right at the same level with him in terms of notoriety, he would say, all right, this guy's, he's a good pianist, wonderful pianist, and so forth. But he would say nothing more. But why is it that he openly said, I wish I could play like Art Tatum, and he demanded, which meant he said, he suggested, Horowitz really demanded to get to know and did get to know Art Tatum. And we know that at least once Tatum was in the townhouse of Vladimir Horowitz. God knows what they must have been doing in terms of the piano. And listen to 10 or 12 seconds of a piece called T for Two by George Gershwin, as done by Vladimir Horowitz on YouTube. Just go for it. Punch in Vladimir Horowitz plays T for Two. He goes about 12 seconds. He loved T for Two. The version of T for Two that was done by Tatum opened the entire world of the possibility of piano playing in a different world for Horowitz. He had to know this man, and they got to know one another. So ask yourself the question, did Tatum have that kind of power? Do you agree with me or not? It's not important, but try to answer it anyway. Thank you.
Ooh, who's buzzed?
Not yet. It's 10 o'clock somewhere.
Not yet.
No, it's not. No.
Thank you, Les.
You're more than welcome.
That went nice and smoothly anyway.
It did, except for the buzz. And well, the couple of little blips with the... I hate Wi-Fi,
I
mean,
too.
Someday there won't be any Wi-Fi anymore. I don't know what there will be, but...
I don't know either.
I don't either.
Well, the important thing is you heard it all.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
It's all that matters.
Yeah. All right, so okay. It's WMFO Medford. It's 10:19 in the morning. Mike and Mark and Les are here till 11. And Mark is going to treat us to some reviews of restaurants and some news and then a set of some songs that are not Americana. And you can find Mark's work on hiddenboston.com. And you have a blog as well, yep. Boston Restaurant Talk.
And a column in Dig Boston.
Mm-hmm.
Shout out to Chris and the gang at Dig, which is doing really well these days, which is great to see.
Mm-hmm.
And they just had a big issue out on a bunch of restaurant reviews, including one of mine, and beer. They review beers too, so definitely check out Dig Boston at some point. Not to shamelessly plug it, but I just did. So
go forward and forth. Okay. And continue.
I will. And as is always the case, or usually the case, I have a lot of bad news. So you want to hear the bad news first or the bad news?
Are you surprised, Les?
No, I hear it all the time.
Okay.
Okay.
No, go ahead.
Four huge closings. First one is Common Ground in Alston, which makes me very sad.
Yeah.
And the owner passed away recently. Oh. And it's just, I guess it's not a huge surprise that it closed, but it's still sad because I really liked it. You know, a good comfort food place and craft beers and cocktails. The one in Alston, Arlington rather, is still open, so that's good. But yeah, the Alston one was kind of a legendary place. Maria's Pastry Shop is closing in the North End, and everyone goes to Mike's and Modern, but Maria's is really the place where locals go. An incredible cannoli, award-winning cannoli, and she's like, all my friends are retired and maybe I should do that too. And so they're going to close in September.
All good things come to an end.
I know. I'm really going to miss it, though.
Yeah.
I mean, their cannoli were incredible. Burger Dive in Assembly Row closed.
Oh, so, I hardly knew you. I never went there.
I know. Yeah, I didn't get there either. It was really good, I guess. Good burgers, and they had spiked milkshakes, which, it's always... But spiked milkshakes are always a good thing, in my opinion.
That's a surprise for a child who orders a milkshake.
Yeah, children don't go to Burger Dive. Actually, they do, but they don't get the shakes. Anyways, no one goes there anymore because it's closed. It might reopen somewhere else, maybe in Boston. I can't tell you where because I don't know, but I hear rumors. And finally, Navy Yard Bistro in Charlestown closed.
Oh, wow.
And that's one of the great locations, one of the great restaurant spaces in Boston. It was in the shipyard area by the water on a cobblestone street. They had a patio out on the cobblestones. It was such a beautiful, beautiful space. Good news is that the people behind Brewer's Fork are going to open a restaurant there.
Oh, that's cool. That's very cool.
But Navy Yard Bistro is a special place, and I think he's trying to open elsewhere, but nothing guaranteed yet. So that is all the bad news that there is.
Yeah, sure.
Good news is a couple of really quick restaurant reviews. First of all, Tavern at the End of the World, and this is for you, Mike Stewart. We talk about this place a lot. It's a great place for bands and comedy, and people go there. It's sketch writing, comedy, you know, comedians get together and they do writing. Great little place. So they changed ownership a while ago.
And they redid the place a little bit, too. They redid it a little.
I like it. I really like the look. It's a little more open now. And the food is much better. I mean, the food was good before, but it's much better now. Some of the best fish and chips I've had in the Boston area. So great to see. It's in Charlestown. It's right on the Somerville border by Sullivan Square. Great little place. Irish pub, mostly. You know, kind of an Irish pub, comfort food place. And finally, Midway Restaurant in Dedham. You ever been there?
No. If you had said Midway Cafe, I'd be, yeah, I've been there.
Oh, Jamaica Plain?
Yeah.
Yeah, I haven't been there. I hear good things about that, too. Midway Restaurant's a different place. Huh. It's very old school, kind of like the Newbridge Cafe, but southwest of Boston. Like, it's probably 60 or 70 years old. Great steak tips, great prime rib on Saturday night. People do prime rib on Saturday night. Kind of like the old school way of doing things where, you know, families would go out and get prime rib on weekends. They have great burgers and chili. Everything is there so good. And it's just one of those places in the middle of, I don't know, just this crazy road, Washington Street, which is, you know, median strip and cars going like 100 miles an hour. And then you see this place, Midway Restaurant. But it's a nice little restaurant.
You going out with your family to have Saturday night prime rib?
And it's like, let's go 100 miles an hour with everyone else down in the Midway Restaurant. Yeah, that's
they were just going out for dinner. And
yeah, and then they went 100 miles an hour, and they hit the Dedham Mall or something. So
see, we've come around to bad again.
Yeah, it's always about the bad news. I could go on and on about bad news, but we should probably play music.
I have such high hopes.
Yeah, well, look who you're dealing with.
Okay,
I mean, we're going from the filet mignon of what we just heard with music to Hamburger Helper right now, basically.
All right, so the songs that you've picked, is it going to be filet or will it be?
It's
going to
be Hamburger Helper. No, actually,
no,
it's. So how did this get started? Basically, Dan Kennedy, who many of you know, he is a professor at Northeastern. He's on WGBH, Beat the Press. He has a column for WGBH. Great guy. I've met him several times. He was on one of my hikes. And we were talking the other day. I don't know. It was a political post on Facebook, and it turned into music, which is good because you don't want to talk politics. So we started talking about music, and he was talking about his five favorite albums because he's a huge music guy. And being a boomer, he's really steeped into classic rock. I'm kind of more of an Xer, but I do appreciate classic rock and got more and more into it now. So we're just talking about the greatest albums out there as far as greatest albums of all time, and his were almost all in the 60s and 70s. And we just started talking about songs within these mammoth albums. And of course, some of them you hear all the time, like Dream On by Aerosmith, or Stairway to Heaven by Led Zeppelin. But there's a lot of songs that you don't hear quite as much among these huge, huge classic rock albums that everyone knows about.
Deep cuts that are really good tracks.
Yeah, mostly deep cuts. I mean, even the deep cuts, you hear them on the radio. Like, all these songs you hear on the radio, but just you don't hear it nearly as much. And it just shows, these songs show how great these albums were, because even the deep cuts are better than 90% of everything you hear out there today.
Yeah, this first one is a great example.
It is, and it's the only song from an American band out of these five, because back in the 60s and late 60s and 70s, all about British bands. But then all of a sudden, Aerosmith came around, and they were really the first huge hard rock band to come out of America. And this was very early 70s, and it just absolutely rocks, as do all these songs.
Okay.
So let's do it.
Start off
with the great Aerosmith from their first album, Walking the Dog.
Walking the Dog. It's WMFO. Medford.
WMFO in Medford.
WMF. Oh, Medford. Some really creepy goodness there from afterwards.
I mean, we had the lights down and the shades drawn and just kind of closing our eyes. And that's a really creepy song late at night. I was just mentioning Robert French that online about how, you know, it's kind of like Hallelujah by Jeff Buckley.
Yep.
Where, you know, you hear that one in the morning and it just creeps you out. But, so there's five songs, you know, lesser played songs off some of the greatest, biggest albums of all time, mostly from that stretch, late 60s to early 80s, when you had the mammoth albums, and I can't see that.
Oh, the Battle of Evermore, of course, from Led Zeppelin 4.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were pointing out something on Facebook.
Oh.
I'm like, I don't care about
Facebook. I just thought you might want to read them back.
Oh,
but I can
do it from my head, I think. I mean, I'm not that smart.
And the Who before that?
So, we're going backwards. Okay. So,
sure.
We can do that. So, yeah, the Battle of Evermore, which is off Led Zeppelin 4, which also was an untitled album. And untitled albums actually have more power sometimes. So, you know, it's just an album cover back when there were albums, and there was no title at all. And kind of a creepy cover, a creepy song. And that song kind of flowed into Stairway to Heaven, which some consider the greatest rock song of all time. And it's just a Sandy Denny from Fairport Convention with Robert Plant kind of musical magic there. So before that was off of Who's Next was Love Ain't For Keeping, which written by Peter Townsend, kind of almost a throwaway song off Who's Next, which was a huge album. But, you know, a throwaway song. That song to me is better than nearly anything that's out there. And just great guitar work from Peter Townsend there. Both of those songs, it's kind of like English folk music. You know, there's a little connection between those two. Before that was The Clash, which is one of the it's the only song not from the early 70s off that list. But London Calling was just a mammoth album. Everything from the album cover with the smashing guitar to all the songs on that. And they were, what were they called, the most dangerous band in rock or whatever. There was some title to
them.
Yeah, and,
like
you know, there was so much fluff going on back then. And then you have The Clash and, you know, Guns of Brixton is another one of those kind of menacing songs that was off an album that had a lot of huge hits. And that was kind of their swan song in some ways. I mean, not really, but they were disappearing quickly after that. Before that, from Exile on Main Street was Sweet Virginia by the Rolling Stones. And Exile's weird. It's a weird album because it's considered one of the greatest albums of all time. But other than Happy and Tumbling Dice, you don't hear any of those songs on the radio. And it's a double album. So I don't really get that. I mean, I know that classic rock stations have their playlists, but it's just so strange. You never hear Sweet Virginia, which is such a beautiful song. And we started off with Aerosmith, 1973, I believe. The first album, that was Walking the Dog, which was actually a Rufus Thomas song. He wrote it, I think, in 63. And everyone did that. Rolling Stones did it. Green Day did it. All these. Roger Daltrey did it. But Aerosmith's version is the one that people
know.
That's
the one you know, yeah.
Yeah. And that's a song that you don't hear a whole lot on the radio anymore, even though that's such a huge album, but you always hear Dream On, of course. And just for your information, I want to embarrass Dan Kennedy. I don't know if he's listening. He's probably out somewhere, but I'll tell you what his top three albums were, that list we had on Facebook. Highway 61 Revisited, Dylan.
Love it.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Exile on Main Street, which is how this got started. We were talking about that album, was number two, and Born to Run by Springsteen, number three. My top three today, changes every day. Wish You Were Here by Pink Floyd, number one. Exile, number two. Who's Next, number three.
Awesome.
Yep.
Great bunch of songs to play.
Yeah, it was fun. Next time I'll get back into all that Britpop stuff. And
you know, I have a question, Mark.
Yeah.
When you described this music from the general period. Is it the mysteriousness of the music that comes out of the times? Did Vietnam affect an escapism or anything like that?
That was a part of it. It was also the blowing up of the end. The hippie generation came to this really big crashing halt with the Altamont, with the, you know, the murder at Altamont and you know, Manson's and Vietnam. And so everything went from love and peace and all that and hippies to kind of a sinister sound that Led Zeppelin had and Black Sabbath and The Who even, and The Stones, of course. So, yeah, a lot of mysterious kind of menacing music that...
So not so much escapism, but kind of a, resignation to the reality of the human spirit?
Yeah. Yeah, it was basically a response to all the kind of fluff that was, I mean, there was great music in the 60s, but it had a harder edge once we got into the early 70s.
As music does over the years, yeah. It's a reflection of the times.
Exactly.
The reason I ask is that the exact opposite, which is so strange to me, occurred during the Second World War, which, of course, was such a horrific... I mean, how many millions of people died during that period?
Yeah.
And the music you get, you know, sit under the apple tree with no one else but me kind
right.
of thing.
Exactly.
A total... reaction the other way, like yeah. total escapism.
It's a cycle. It always yeah. seems to keep happening.
It's amazing
like that,
what so. Music can do.
It is.
So,
yeah. All right. So at 10:51, I want to end with a short set, starting with some new noise from a good friend of ours. We all know her from Boston Radio. Lisa Traxler posted this the other day, she just, you know, she was a musician as well as a DJ. You know, she played in. What was it called? House of Joy. And this gentleman, Dave Charles, was also in House of Joy, also in Sidewalk Gallery, The Derangers, and he played on countless sessions. But he's got a new release here called Not Gone, and it's just fabulous. And what she says about it is, this sounds best loud. So thanks, Lisa.
Crank
for the,
it.
Thanks for the new noise. This yeah. is called Not Gone by Dave Charles.
Take a suitcase for I can't believe
Tears of the sun. Can't you see what we have done?